Please be seated. Good afternoon. Ready for our third case today, 11AP1572, Julaine K. Appling versus Scott Walker. Arguing on behalf of the Alliance Defense Fund will be Austin R. Nimux. He's going to be introduced by Michael Dean of Brookfield, Wisconsin.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. Michael Dean, Wisconsin counsel for plaintiffs petitioners. Arguing will be Austin Nimix, admitted pro hoc vice, Alliance Defending Freedom from Washington, D.C. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Nimux. Welcome to Wisconsin.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice.
You're authorized to argue today, but then you're to leave immediately and not do anything else. You may proceed.
Thank you very much. Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court. The family section of the Wisconsin Code establishes a legal status for domestic relations. This legal status allows a consensual union of two people, not closely related by blood, and of a specific sex, to form a consensual domestic union to the exclusion of all others. And while what I've described sounds like marriage, I'm in fact describing Chapter 770, the Domestic Partnership Law. This case is not about benefits. This case is rather about Chapter 770 mimicking marriage's blueprint in the Wisconsin Code, a blueprint which does not rise or fall upon the extension of any particular benefit or incident of law thereto. This court, in past precedent, has described marriage as a relation, and a relation that extends a status as between the parties and to the community in general. It is the relation of marriage to which the marriage amendment at issue speaks in this particular case. If the Wisconsin legislature was to change any of the incidents or benefits associated with marriage, as it oftentimes does, that in and of itself does not change the marriage relationship. It is understood as described in Chapter 765 of the Wisconsin Code.
But what is the marriage relationship?
The marriage relationship, Madam Chief Justice, is described in Chapter 765, and it is almost identical to Chapter 770. It is a relationship that two people may enter into. There is a consanguinity requirement. It is sex-specific. They must be to the exclusion of all others, and, of course, a consensual union. Those what we call the constituent elements, the elements that are necessary that form the marital relationship, are repeated in Chapter 770. And the legislature, in enacting Chapter 770, described the legal status of domestic partnership as described in this chapter. Those were the words that the legislature used. The entirety of the legal status provided by Chapter 770 is in Chapter 770 because the benefits or incidents associated therewith are in other provisions of the Wisconsin Code. And one cannot argue, we believe, that were the legislature to change the benefits or incidents associated with Chapter 770, that change in and of itself would alter the legal status of domestic partnership under Wisconsin law. In looking at whether or not Chapter 770 is in fact constitutional, petitioners maintain that this court need look no further than the plain language of the marriage amendment at issue. This court has done that in other cases before. You are not required, we believe, according to this court's precedent, to go into all of the factors, the three factors traditionally outlined and outlined, for example, in the Darrowin case.
Counsel, let me interrupt you, if I might, for a moment. Before reading the briefs, I wasn't aware of the terms constituent elements. Do you basically mean by that formation requirements?
Not necessarily, Justice Crook. The formation requirements for the marital relationship, I think, inform the nature of the legal status. Because when you look at what is required for parties to enter into a marriage, you understand better what the nature of the legal status is that's created. And I think when this court describes marriage as a relation, we're looking at the essence. What is the essence of marriage? And so when this court said in McConkie, for example, that the second sentence was designed to make sure that the first sentence was not illusory, well, what would make marriage illusory? Looking at the essence of marriage and whether something mimics it. I hope I'm being responsive to your question there.
Yes, sir.
I think the formation requirements do inform the court as to what is in marriage, but understand that a legal status doesn't exist until the relationship is in fact formed. And so the process of forming the relationship, we don't believe is necessarily dispositive to what the legal status is. But what its essence is, what is inside the legal status, we do believe is informative.
So what is inside?
What is inside a legal status is a relationship, as this court has described, a relation. And what is the relation, what is the status that the parties hold towards each other and to the community at large, to borrow from this court's language in the Duckett case that we cite in our brief. And that particular relationship is informed by the formation requirements.
What's the formation requirements? One, age, right?
Age is a requirement, yes, ma'am.
And domestic partnership has to be 18.
Yes, ma'am, that's correct.
And marriage?
Marriage 18 is the general rule, but there can be an exception for up to, I think, down to 16 years.
So if we change the domestic, the legislature changed the domestic partnership to 20 or 16, would that invalidate or validate the law in your opinion?
If the legislature were to change the age requirement in Chapter 770, we do not believe that that would cure its constitutional infirmness.
All right. Then we get to gender. On the domestic partnership, you have to be the same sex in marriage, man and woman.
The sex-specific requirement as to both of them, we believe, makes them substantially similar. We don't believe the fact that a Chapter 770 domestic partnership requires same sex versus marriage opposite sex is necessarily a difference that, or a distinction that makes a constitutional difference. They are sex specific, Madam Chief Justice, and as to every other legal status in Wisconsin law, there is no other that I'm aware of that requires sex specificity. Marriage and domestic partnership stand alone. As to every other form of legal status or relationship in Wisconsin law that requires sex specificity, whether you want to look at a landlord-tenant relationship or a parent-child relationship, look at any other legal status. That is unique to marriage. And we believe that the legislature would not have included that requirement unless there was an intent.
Suppose that they said that you could have a man and a woman engage into a domestic partnership, would that cure the law?
It would be a start, Madam Chief Justice. We believe
a good start.
It would be, excuse me?
A good start.
Well, I'm not going to pass a judgment on the wisdom of the change.
All right.
But it would be a start to curing the constitutional problem that we assert exists. We believe that in addition to that, there would have to be a change to the consanguinity requirement.
Pardon me? What would the change have to be?
The consanguinity requirement, not closely related.
Consanguinity, okay.
Yes, ma'am.
All right. That deals with cannot be nearer of kin than second cousins, whether by whole or half blood or by adoption. That's on the domestic partnership, right?
Yes, ma'am, that's correct.
So what do you have to, and then on the marriage, cannot be nearer of kin than second cousins, whether by whole or half blood, except for age 55. Can be 55 and have marriage.
That's correct. There
that
are
seems
a, couple
a little arbitrary and capricious, doesn't it?
I don't believe so, Justice Bradley, because like the sex-specific...
I was teasing.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
55! You know what I mean? Looks good to me. I'm sorry.
Go ahead. That's consanguinity. All right.
And I believe it's important to note, Madam Chief Justice, that like the sex-specific requirement, consanguinity is unique to marriage. That is not a requirement imposed upon any other legal status of which I'm aware under Wisconsin law. And so, but for an intent to mimic or follow marriage's blueprint, the sex-specific requirement and the consanguinity requirement would not be part of Chapter 770.
I'm he's going to.
So if that would have to be changed, and you have to eliminate the consanguinity issue for domestic partnership, and then it would be okay in your view.
I believe if those two requirements were changed by the legislature, it would be a much closer question, and I wouldn't want to deprive this court of any legislative history or debate that may surround all that. But each individual requirement other than those two does exist in other form relationships or legal statuses in Wisconsin, but together do form collectively the legal status of marriage or the understanding, nature, or essence of marriage that we think when work together are very important. And so when the marriage amendment specifically says another other legal status that is substantially similar, obviously we're looking at, I believe, what the essence of marriage is and the things that are unique specifically to marriage. And in terms of the formation requirements or what is inside the legal status of marriage, the sex specificity and consanguinity are very significant features of marriage, not just in Wisconsin, but throughout the country and in the history of the marriage relationship.
Counsel, I took from your brief that you wouldn't have much problem about eliminating that consanguinity requirement.
That if I understand your question, Justice Prosser, that if that consanguinity requirement was eliminated, that there would no longer be a constitutional infirmity with Chapter 7-7?
Oh, I didn't make that point, but it seemed to me I thought you said that particular requirement in the domestic partnership didn't make much sense to you.
We agree that having a consanguinity requirement in a Chapter 770 domestic partnership does not make much sense unless there is an intent to mimic or intimate the marital relationship because of the consanguinity requirement being unique only to marriage. It could only be in there unless we're trying to mimic marriage and creating a new domestic relationship. And I don't think there's any dispute that a domestic partnership is a domestic relationship and is a domestic relationship that contemplates two adults in an intimate setting, much like marriage. And so that consanguinity requirement definitely, we think, in and of itself would make Chapter 770 constitutionally infirm because you are borrowing one of the most significant features of the marital relationship from time immemorial in that regard. So the sex specificity, I think, and the consanguinity requirement essentially both in and of themselves and together function to make Chapter 770 substantially similar to marriage and we would say even virtually identical when you consider the fact that all of the other elements of a Chapter 770 domestic partnership, as alluded to in Chapter 770, are virtually identical to marriage, from the number of persons to the age requirements that we've discussed, the exclusivity requirement, that one cannot be, in fact, in a domestic partnership and in a marriage at the same time. No other legal status of which I'm aware has an exclusivity requirement. You can be a landlord and you can be a parent all at the same time. You can be a taxpayer and hold all kinds of legal statuses, but you cannot be in more than one marriage or in a marriage and a domestic partnership at the same time. And the exclusivity requirement is also a unique feature, we believe, to
marriage.
Well,
there are a lot of other exclusivity. You can be a member of the bench, but you can't practice law. You can be a member of the judiciary, but you can't run for other state office, even during your term, even if you quit. Consanguinity is a practice is a requirement in other sexual relationships, not just marriage. 944.06, non-marital sexual intercourse with a person of a blood relative is not permitted. So it goes farther than domestic relationship or not. And is consanguinity in conflicts of interest in public contracting? So these are matters that go farther than domestic relationship or domestic partnership or marriage.
Madam,
they run throughout the course of statute books.
I would say in response to that, Madam Chief Justice, that I do believe that those requirements are unique to marriage, inasmuch that marriage is recognized as a legal status. And that is, I really think, the sum of it here. Either you may have a prohibition on having consensual sexual relationships with somebody who was a certain kin. But that prohibition is not a legal status, nor does it create one. Marriage as a legal status has these certain core or constituent elements that we describe, and we think it is unique in that regard, because marriage and domestic partnership are two domestic legal statuses that exist by themselves apart from every other form of legal status under Wisconsin law.
Counsel, if I can interrupt again for a moment. During the noon hour, I was looking at Chapter 40 of the Wisconsin statutes. It relates to state employees' benefits, same-sex benefits. The formation requirements seem to be somewhat akin to, in fact, closely following Chapter 770. Are you taking the position that those would also be unconstitutional?
No, Justice Crooks, and for several reasons. First and foremost, Section 40.02, I believe it is, that you're alluding to, is not at issue in this particular lawsuit. One of the things that 40.02 does not address is sex specificity. It does have a consanguinity requirement, but I think more significantly than that, it does not have a statewide effect. We're talking about a limited benefit provided statutorily for, I think it's for state employees, if I recall correctly. And so that is not the type of statewide legal status that we believe is specifically contemplated by Article 13, Section 13 of the Constitution. And I think that in terms of the scope and the breadth of the legal status, this is one place where the history of the debates is informative of the court, and it was made very clear during the course of the 3 years that this was debated, this amendment from 2004 to the end of 2006, that there would not have an impact on, for example, a municipal level domestic partnership benefits package, much like 40.02, because it is not of a statewide level or significance.
What about wrongful death benefits under 895.04 sub 2? Are you saying that that statute's unconstitutional because it gives them to those engaged in a domestic partnership?
Justice Rogensack, I have not read that statute, but our position would be that that benefit can be extended to domestic partners so long as how the state defines a domestic partner is not substantially similar to marriage. And so I don't think it's necessarily a function of the benefit. It goes back to the legal status that is created by Chapter 770 and whether or not that legal status in and of itself survives scrutiny. And so one of the themes that was reverberatingly clear during the course of the 3 years that this amendment was being debated is that no particular benefits or privileges would be unavailable under this particular amendment. That was stated by the amendment sponsors from in January 2004 when it was admitted, first introduced, all the way to the very end of the campaign. And so as long as the legal status through which benefits may be disseminated in and of itself is not substantially similar to marriage, no particular benefits or privileges would be off the table, so to speak. And because if you transformed Chapter 770 into a relationship like a reciprocal beneficiaries package, one of the things that was mentioned during the debates, it's where two sisters who live together could benefit from that. While they may receive marital incidents or benefits, nobody looks at that relationship between the two sisters who are living together as a marital relationship. And that's the core and the focus and the essence of the marriage amendment here, focusing by its express language and its plain language on the status of the relationship and not the effect of that relationship or the benefits or the incidents, like other constitutional amendments on marriage that were enacted. Wisconsin made a very intentional and deliberate choice to focus on the legal status.
You're referring to the amendment.
Yes, sir. I'm referring to the amendment.
And just prior to the questioning from the bench beginning, you were about to talk about how this court should not feel compelled or required to look at all three factors from the Dareland case. But before that, you made reference to the McConkie decision. And I read with interest in your brief, and I listened closely as you began your argument, and you cited McConkie in both, almost as if it provided the answer to today's question. And I'm not sure I'm following you, because I'm reading the bottom of paragraph 53 and the pertinent parts of paragraph 54, where the court unanimously found that the amendment was an effort to preserve and constitutionalize the status quo, not to alter the existing character or legal status of marriage. And then going down to the last sentence for the sake of time, of paragraph 54, we need not decide what legal statuses identical or substantially similar to marriage are prohibited by this clause in order to understand its plain and general purpose. Doesn't that seem to leave the question open for another day, which, as it turns out, is this day? And then I have a question about the historical context.
Okay. Well, let me answer that first question, Justice Gableman.
Of course.
And it was not my suggestion that McConkie is necessarily in and of itself dispositive of the case before the court.
Certainly.
I do draw, however, from the court's interpretation of the second sentence as to not render the first one illusory, and the usage of the verbiage regarding the character of marriage. And that's important, because when we're talking about the character of something, we're going to the core or its essence. And that's where our argument emanates from, is that the amendment was designed to pretend the character of marriage, and it doesn't have anything to do textually or otherwise necessarily with the benefits.
But the argument has changed since 2006. I think you'd have to concede that.
I do not agree, Justice Gableman, that the argument has changed.
And I base that observation on petitioner's appendix, page 53. The circuit court made a finding of fact. And I'm reading at page 22 of the circuit court's decision. The court wrote, you don't have to worry about finding. I promise to read it word for word.
Okay.
The vast majority of informational materials available during the ratification campaign reveal that voters were repeatedly told that the purpose of the marriage amendment was to prohibit same-sex marriage and Vermont-style civil unions. Now, that's a finding of fact, which no one has asked us to review for a lack of a basis in the record. And I notice that Vermont-style marriage appears a lot in the materials. Most of us have reviewed the record, if not all of it. And so I was curious to know what Vermont-style marriage referred to. So over the lunch hour in our chambers, we did look up the relevant statute from 2006, Vermont 15 VSA, Vermont Statutes Annotated, section 1204. Subsection A is very brief, and it says, parties to a civil union shall have all the same benefits, protections, and responsibilities under law, whether they derive from statute, administrative or court rule, policy, common law, or any other source of civil law, as are granted to spouses in a marriage. So the argument hasn't changed?
It has not, Justice Gableman, and here's why. When the Circuit Court and the Court of Appeals both interpreted the phrase Vermont-style civil union to mean only a civil union that extends all the rights, benefits, and privileges, not once did either court look at what a Vermont-style civil union is, which is exactly what Chapter 770 is. It is a marriage-mirroring legal status. It mirrors the exact requirements. You will not find in the legislative history from 2004 to 2006 a statement of a single proponent or legislative sponsor who characterized a Vermont-style civil union as one that extended all the benefits and privileges of marriage. That was an interpretation that the Circuit Court and the Court of Appeals both.
Wait. I'm not following you, because it almost seems like you're implying that we, in our consideration of the historical context, are bound by how somebody else defined a term that they used. If they said Vermont-style civil union, and I just read the pertinent part of the statute, doesn't it seem to be that's what we should be looking at?
Well, With respect, Justice Gamelin, I don't think that that is the pertinent part of the statute. You read Section 1204, but I think Section 1202, which is the requisites of a valid civil union under Vermont law, is really what's more pertinent.
So that's what the argument was in 2006. Justice Crooks asked earlier about the constituent parts, whether that's synonymous with formation. Your first word was no, and then it was followed by something that I'm less than clear on. So that's what the argument, that's what was meant in the literature and in the historical context, was the constituent parts.
Absolutely, because you will see that the legislative sponsors and the proponents said you cannot create a marriage-like relationship. As long as the legal status or the legal construct was a phrase used commonly by Representative Gundrum and Senator Fitzgerald, legal construct is not marriage-like. No particular benefits or privileges would be withheld. That is a quote from their introductory memo and their follow-up memo that they did almost 2 years later, I think in November of 2005. And that theme is consistent throughout. The Vermont-style civil union mimicked marriage. It had all the requisite requirements of marriage in Vermont, except it was only for same-sex couples. It is virtually identical to Chapter 770, and that is exactly what the legislative proponents and the amendment proponents during the campaign were saying time and time again. They said, along with that, that it was not a question. I see that my time has expired.
May I complete your sentence?
Thank you very much. That it was not a question of benefits, but it was a question of marriage mimicking legal statuses. Thank you.
Counsel, while you're seated, I'd like you to consider, should you prevail, does that render the constitutional amendment a violation of the federal constitution? Christopher Clark, Lambda Legal Defense and Education Fund in Chicago, you're going to be introduced by Barbara Nider. Counsel?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. I am very pleased to be able to introduce to you Attorney Christopher Clark, who will be presenting the argument on behalf of the Fair Wisconsin Defendant Respondent Group. As you mentioned, Mr. Clark is with Lambda Legal Defense and Education Fund in Chicago, Illinois. He's a member of the Illinois Bar and has been admitted pro hac vice. I have been honored to work with him in this case, and with the Court's permission, I'll turn the podium over to him at this time.
Thank you, counsel. Permission granted. You, too, are welcome, and you have permission to argue this case, counsel.
Thank you very much. It's an honor and pleasure to be here. May it please the Court, I am Christopher Clark, and I am here on behalf of the intervening defendants. I would first like to touch on something that we haven't touched on yet, the burden of proof. If any doubt exists, any doubt, it must be resolved in favor of the constitutionality of the statute. The petitioners have the burden of proving, beyond a reasonable doubt, that the state's domestic partnership registry creates a legal status that is substantially similar to marriage. Now, in a constitutional challenge like this one, that burden of proof is an expression of the heavy deference that this Court shows to the legislature. The acts of the legislature are presumed to be constitutional, and as this Court has stated, it will indulge every presumption to sustain the law, if at all possible. But in this case, there's very little doubt. Under every aspect of the three-part constitutional interpretive analysis adopted by this Court, it is clear that a Wisconsin domestic partnership is not substantially similar to marriage. The Court of Appeals agreed, finding that the petitioners had fallen far short of meeting their burden of proof. The Circuit Court said that a domestic partnership was, quote, not even close to a Vermont-style civil union.
Counsel, if the purpose of the domestic partnership statute was not to be substantially similar to marriage, what would be the purposes for the for the degree of separation of relation and for the age requirements. And in the hypothetical that your opposing counsel cited in his brief, the granddaughter caring for a sick grandfather. Why couldn't those people be eligible if the intent was not to create a relationship substantially similar to marriage?
I think the purpose of the legislation was to provide a limited number of important protections to same-sex couples and their families, and to do it entirely consistent with the marriage amendment that had passed in 2006. And that's why there was an extensive examination in 2009 when the legislature considered passing the domestic partnership registry about the constitutionality of the statute. And that's why the nonpartisan Wisconsin Legislative Council concluded that which was being proposed was fully consistent with the constitutional amendment. The purpose was to provide these important benefits to same-sex couples. You can do that in a manner that falls far short of marriage, as is done here, and not create a legal status that is substantially similar to marriage.
And you use that word status. And that is the focus of significant disagreement between the parties. And what I would like to hear is, first of all, your interpretation of what status we should be considering, as well as your response to your opposing counsel's argument that we should be looking at the constituent parts as he has defined them.
We set forth in our brief our position that legal status refers to one's standing in the eyes of the law. And so it would be the standing of someone who is married or someone who is in a domestic partnership and how the law treats them and that relationship, which would require an examination of the different legal aspects of the status, including the so-called constituent elements, but as well the entry or exit procedures of the status, for example, and all of the attendant legal rights, benefits, and responsibilities.
And by entrance and exit, you're referring to the solemnization and divorce proceedings.
Correct. And the reason why that is so important, I think, relates to your question about the constituent elements. Because we've heard, you know, a lot in the briefs and today about constituent elements. It is a term that sort of first appears in the briefing in this case. And it's not, you will not find it in the voter ratification materials or the legislative debates. But, you know, there's something missing even in the explanation of the constituent elements. And I was struck by both the questions about that and the question that I think started us off, which was, what is the marriage relationship? That was one of the first questions asked. And so I went to the statute right away. Marriage is defined under the law. And the law says that marriage, so far as its validity at law is concerned, is a civil contract, in which the consent of the parties capable in law of contracting is essential, and which creates the legal status of husband and wife. So we know from the statute that it is a civil contract. But what type of civil contract? That is also answered in Chapter 765. It is a civil contract in which two people come together and agree to be bound by a mutual obligation of support. And it is such a unique contract under the law that the state, in fact, becomes somewhat of a third party to the contract. They will enforce that obligation of mutual obligation and support.
Is there a mutual obligation of support in the domestic partnership law?
There is not. There is not that same mutual obligation of support. It is not a contractual relationship, or if it is a contractual relationship, it is one of a very, very different character.
Well, one party to the contract can remove themselves from the relationship.
Correct, and that relates to the sort of exit procedures. With marriage, you have to get a divorce. You need the state's permission in order to exit your marriage. With respect to a domestic partnership, you can unilaterally decide you don't want to be in that domestic partnership. You can go down to the county clerk, sign an affidavit, notice is given to your partner, and you are done. You do not owe your partner any sort of mutual obligation of support.
Which is required
nature.
Under a contract, which Correct. Is an essential element of a contract.
Correct. Now, but, and so I would submit that the legal nature of marriage as a contract and a unique contract in that way is certainly one of the, quote, constituent elements of the relationship, not that the analysis is limited to constituent elements. And, you know, the argument today about constituent elements is inconsistent with the legal opinions found in three separate memos of the nonpartisan Wisconsin Legislative Council. One in 2004, the second in 2006, the third in 2009. It's inconsistent with a 2006 opinion of the then Attorney General. It's inconsistent with the 2009 opinion of Professor David Schwartz of the University of Wisconsin Law School, who was asked by then Governor Doyle to analyze the amendment in light of the proposed domestic partnership registry. And it is an argument about the constituent elements that was flatly rejected by Judge Mosier of the Dane County Circuit Court and by a unanimous panel in the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals said the argument about constituent elements lacked common sense.
It seems to me you're looking at different sides of the issue. I understand the briefs and the oral argument today. Plaintiffs here, petitioners here, look at the constituent parts. They look at the age, the gender, the consanguinity, and they say, hey, this is the only place you find that. That defines marriage. You say, if I read your arguments correctly, there are just a lot of things that define marriage, not necessarily my marriage or your marriage, but define marriage in the statutes, like mutual obligation of support. Not very many people have obligations of support, right?
Right.
And that's part of marriage. Marital property, how we hold our property, it's part of the marriage, right? Divorce, separation, child custody, adoption, a whole variety of things that deal with this. Also, unemployment insurance, which is not necessarily available if you're not married. Spousal veterans benefits, well, that may be different now. People challenging this domestic partnership law say these benefits are not relevant because they're not attacking any of the benefits. They're saying the government can give all those benefits to same-sex people, but that doesn't make it a marriage. But labeling a domestic partnership and identifying who can be domestic partners by age, gender, and consanguinity does make it a marriage. Have I isolated your arguments properly?
I think you've summarized the arguments with respect to what is the plain meaning of the marriage amendment.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why, and with due respect, I think our argument is one based in common sense and plain meaning. But if there's disagreement about that, it is certainly helpful to go to the other portions of the constitutional analysis, and you will find in this record that the petitioners themselves, as well as the legislative sponsors of this amendment, repeatedly told legislators and voters that this amendment would allow the legislature to do exactly what it did here, which was to create a legal construct for same-sex couples and provide them with a package of benefits. So long as that package of benefits did not create a legal status that was substantially similar to marriage. What does that mean? It was said over and over again what substantially similar meant, a Vermont-style civil union, which is, in essence, a legal status that provides all of the legal rights, benefits, and responsibilities of marriage through a different name to same-sex couples, including things like the mutual obligation of support, the access to the divorce system, and all of those other things. So I do think it's quite helpful to go to both the legislative record and the voter ratification campaign, because I believe that that supports the argument that we have put forward with respect to the plain meaning. And again, I sort of circle back to the burden of proof. If you think there are two sort of competing interpretations of this plain meaning, the fact that we have put forward an entirely legitimate interpretation, one of which was adopted by two courts below and is supported by the legislative record and the voter ratification campaign, I think that we are far cry from meeting a beyond a reasonable doubt burden of proof.
Counsel, one of the arguments that the petitioners make in their briefs is one that hasn't been discussed yet, and it goes to finality of litigation. All things being equal, the law favors finality. And in their brief, petitioners argue that if this court adopts your reasoning, your client's reasoning, that the door will be open for the legislature, and I'm on page, and again, don't bother. I'll read slow, and I promise to read them all. Page 27 of petitioner's brief. Because the people did not select language requiring that analysis, the lower court's approach, that is the approach, as you know, of comparing benefits, rights, and obligations, should be avoided because it will never produce a settled result and is not a firm foundation for sound jurisprudence. And of course, what is meant by that is explained elsewhere, which is if we adopt your client's reasoning, that there's very little to stop the legislature from continuing to add rights and obligations so that a Vermont-style civil union is created. What is your response to that?
You know, I have to start my response by saying that certainly is not before the court. What we're dealing with is what we have in place. But I understand that only goes so far in terms of
It comes under the heading of finality of litigation.
I understand. I think the argument is premised on a mischaracterization, number one, of what was done in the courts below. So the courts below did not engage in a sort of benefit counting exercise, and this is not about whether simply you add additional benefits, do you start to get up against substantially similar. They addressed actually all aspects of the constitutional analysis and all aspects of the legal nature of the status, including things like the so-called constituent elements, the entry and exit procedures. Until the legislature gets someplace close to the Vermont-style civil union that was referenced all over those voter ratification materials, we're not anywhere close to the line. So you could add, you know, certainly additional benefits to the package. You're not changing the fundamental difference between these two statuses, which one is a contractual relationship under the law, explicitly so in the statute, and one is not.
But your opposing counsel argues in brief, in briefing, that there is no line, that there is no discernible line, and therefore uncertainty will be the result, and no law, no line drawing, this court will not be capable of any line drawing.
I think the briefs, you know, tease out the arguments that provide a you know, pretty good approximation of the line to be drawn, which is, again, the Vermont-style civil union. I think the voter ratification materials, for example, you know, there's a debate about sort of who said what, but there was some consistency in the materials that you pointed out, which was that substantially similar refers to this Vermont-style civil union. And so, you know, I think that's a fairly sort of clear line. Now, the truth of the matter is there aren't that many states that have those anymore. Illinois happens to be one of them where I live. But, you know, there aren't that many examples left because other states are moving to other legal relationships.
Well, and I don't think any of us want to make Vermont sort of, you know, as goes Vermont, so goes Wisconsin. I mean, necessarily. Nor, from a legal principle, in my opinion, as I sit right here, would it be advisable for this court to defer entirely to that one part of the historical context that relates to, and the circuit court found, and my review of the materials does nothing for me to question the circuit court's finding of fact that Vermont-style civil unions was sort of the phrase, the catchphrase that was used frequently. So where do, you know, what would, in your opinion, what would trigger? Would it have to be this broad statement from the Vermont statutes that the members of a domestic partnership are accorded all of the rights and obligations as those in a civil marriage, or would there be something less at which this court would look and say it's substantially similar? It's not entirely Vermont. It's not entirely the equivalent of marriage because that's not the standard.
Maybe this is helpful. I think a comparison of the legal, all of the legal attributes of marriage to whatever the hypothetical status is that you're sort of trying to...
It is a hypothetical.
Exactly. So is there a substantial difference in the eyes of the law between those two statuses? That would be a standard that could be used to determine whether the two statuses are substantially different or not. So there could be different ways of doing that. So if the legislator would create a Vermont-style civil union, but, you know, at the same time chop out sort of whole sections of the law that don't sort of apply to that status, that a court may determine to be still substantially dissimilar. And similarly, if there's no extension of this contractual mutual obligation of support in the creation of the status, I would put forward that that is a substantial difference that would make that hypothetical status still constitutional. You know, it's hard to imagine in a hypothetical context exactly where that line is drawn, but as long as there remains a substantial difference, legal difference, between the two statuses, I think an alternative status could still be considered to be constitutional.
Counsel, as you're well aware, last spring, the U.S. Supreme Court rendered a decision in regard to the Defense of Marriage Act. Basically, it was a very split decision, 5-4. Is there anything from that decision, looking at the majority or the dissenters, that might be of assistance to us today in making a determination in regard to the issue before us?
A couple of things, I think. So in the Windsor decision, which struck down a portion of the Defense of Marriage Act, the Supreme Court, in essence, concluded that a legal marriage in Massachusetts or Iowa or one of the states that allows it, in which the federal government did not extend all of the federal rights and benefits of marriage, that was so unequal under the law that it violated a constitutional guarantee. I would suggest that, and of course the status we're talking about today is a far cry from a legal marriage in a state that recognizes it where you don't get the federal benefits. I would submit it's a further stretch from full-blown marriage. You know, I think that in that sense, I think the case is instructive in that it shows that things that are very much perhaps like marriage in some regards, are in areas of the law considered to be quite unsimilar. Now, again, we are talking about constitutional concepts versus very specific constitutional language here. But perhaps what is also instructive is the ways in which various federal agencies have gone about implementing the Windsor decision, which is, for example, the IRS has determined that if you are legally married in a jurisdiction in the state and in a same-sex relationship, you can file a joint tax return and get various benefits as a married couple, regardless of where you live. So if you live in Illinois and are legally married in Massachusetts, you will be considered to be married for federal government purposes. I think there was an announcement within the last few days, a similar interpretation from the Office of Personnel Management with respect to the Family Medical Leave Act, that you will be entitled to treat your spouse as a spouse, regardless of where you live, if you are legally married elsewhere. In all of these interpretations by the federal government of the Windsor decision, they say, if you're legally married elsewhere, not if you are in a civil union or a domestic partnership. And so the federal government is continuing to draw a line between people who are married and people who are not.
But I think Justice Scalia pointed out that the decision may apply to those folks who are legally married under state law. Its construct is certainly broader than that decision.
The construct of?
Of the Windsor decision is broader than that decision.
Correct.
Otherwise, it could have just totally stopped with saying that it's based on state law and the legal status of marriage under state law, but that's not what he did.
All I'm suggesting is that the manner in which the federal government is implementing it is showing that the federal government views even a full-blown civil union, a Vermont-style civil union, if you will, and certainly a Wisconsin domestic partnership, as very, very different than a legal same-sex marriage from a jurisdiction in which you can get married. And so in that sense, I think the opinion and its implementation can be instructive and helpful.
Counsel, your opposing counsel was asked questions about benefits, state benefits, and seemed to suggest that the ruling in the favor of the plaintiff wouldn't affect other benefits. Justice Rogensack asked a question about the wrongful death statute, which specifically makes reference to, if the deceased leaves a spouse or domestic partner under 770. So you've got a statute that makes specific reference. It seems to me that if this statute, 770, were struck down, that there would be some implications for the wrongful death statute, or future litigation, at least. And yet your opposing counsel seemed to suggest that there would be no, I heard him to say, no ramifications on other benefits in the state, municipal or state.
There are enormous ramifications for couples and their families in this state with respect to what's before us here today. The Domestic Partnership Registry provides somewhere in the neighborhood of 30 to 40 critical legal benefits and protections for same-sex couples. And I believe that the way it's done is there's the creation of the registry and then individual statutes are tied to the legal status that is created. And the legal security of having those benefits and protections would evaporate if this were to be struck down. And so the legislature would have to go back and, in essence, try to fix that with respect to each and every individual status. Again, it would depend on the basis for striking this down. But there are very real ramifications for couples and their families here, including, I think, the one that was referenced.
Counsel, 770.001 is a declaration of policy. And that's very favorable to you. Is it fair to consider that in view of the fact that it's this whole act as being what's challenged?
And I want to make sure I understand. I think you're asking me about the sort of third part of the Dairyland analysis and should it be given weight in light of the fact that the challenge statute is the first legislative action. I sort of go back to where I started, which is I think it's relevant with respect to the issue of the burden of proof. And it's in some sense why we have the third part of the analysis, is to sort of say, well, what has the legislature determined, both in passing the law and with respect to that? What we lay out in the brief is, I think, the story of a very careful consideration in 2009, both reflected in the statement that you were referring to, as well as the memo from the Wisconsin Legislative Council and the fact that the then governor went out and got an independent legal opinion. And the point being that the legislature then in 2009, which is an independent body with an independent obligation and responsibility to act in a manner that's consistent with the Constitution, did that in a way that was deliberate? Did it in a way that was careful and was understanding of the issue that we have today. And so I leave it to you to determine the relative weight to give these various factors, but I think it is entirely consistent to look at that in light of the burden of proof and the existing precedent with respect to the three factors.
The petitioner here places very, very heavy weight on the fact that the political makeup of the legislature changed from the time of the constitutional amendment to the time of the adoption of 770. And so I don't remember when looking at, I think, the Benno case in Darrell, and that we looked at the partisanship makeup, and that we handle that. We tend to look at the legislature as a continuing body, which it's not. That isn't. Nor is the governor, nor is this court. So what do you make of that?
I think it relates to the point I was just making about the legislature being an independent branch of the government with an independent duty to act in a constitutional way. There is no legal precedent cited that we should adjust how we view that based on the changing tides of politics. And I think, quite frankly, it's a very cynical argument that does a disservice to that idea of independent branches of government who should act constitutionally. This court is the final arbiter of what is constitutional.
Well,
but in a constitutional analysis, you have stated that there is deference given to that legislature, and it is not a deference given to one political party or the other.
You have to be careful, because I wrote relying too heavily on contemporaneous legislative action would be ill-advised in all instances, because the court, not the legislature, is the final arbiter of the meaning of the Wisconsin Constitution. Now I'm quoting from the petitioner's brief. It is not this court's task to merely acquiesce to or place its imprimatur upon the legislature's self-serving declaration that Chapter 770 doesn't run afoul of the state constitution. To do that, and here's where we raise the flag for the judiciary, to do that would permit the legislature to arrogate to itself control over the judicial branch.
And
what do you say about that?
Which is why I think we go to lengths in our brief to point out that it's difficult to characterize what happened in 2009 with that legislature as something that was self-serving. They went out and obtained a nonpartisan legal opinion with respect to what they were about to do, one which was confirmed by a respected law professor. And so, you know, one can choose to disagree with those analyses, but I think it's hard to make an argument that the legislature was acting in a self-serving, politically motivated way.
Counselor, you have chosen to defend Chapter 770 because it was attacked as a whole. But should the court consider whether all the provisions of Chapter 770 need to remain in place? For example, should the court consider whether to uphold the chapter but to take out the consanguinity requirement as not being rationally related to really anything in particular that has shown up in the discussions about why the chapter was proposed?
I think the issue before the court is to determine whether this domestic partnership registry as created by Chapter 770 is constitutional or not.
I agree and that not, is the issue.
And not to go in and rewrite it in a manner, especially based on a legal argument that is inconsistent with what was said to the voters. The purpose of the constitutional interpretation that we're arguing about is to realize the intent of the framers and the voters. And this focus on what my opponents characterize as the constituent elements is not what was said to the voters. It was not what was said by the framers of this legislation. And so to either strike this down or rewrite this based on that would, in my opinion, be an error and would be a disservice to the voters who passed this. And I'll close with by saying it's not even what the petitioners said to this court the last time around. If you will recall, there was a petition for this court to exercise its original jurisdiction over this matter. And in that petition, the petitioner said, when determining what constitutes a legal status, this court should look at the underlying nature of the status, who it is for, how it is created, what it entails, its official endorsement, its public appearance and function, in order to determine whether it is substantially similar to marriage. What I just read to you was a petition to this court to exercise its jurisdiction. That's what they said substantially similar analysis was about. And what we're hearing today is not consistent with that. It's not consistent with what was said to the voters.
Well, I think that lawyers that practice for a long time before various levels of courts do tend to change their arguments as they go along, because if they don't prevail on one, they may prevail on another. However, the argument is not being made to us today that we should take out just one section, but it certainly is something that we generally don't approach a whole chapter as being unconstitutional or not, or constitutional. I can't remember ever having a whole chapter. Well, yes, I can. Chapter 980, I think, had the same kind of same kind of arguments, but certainly very different than what we're used to determining. And so my question to you, obviously, is not in your briefs. You fairly responded to the arguments that were made to you, but it was something that I was personally wondering about, and I take your answer to be no, I shouldn't do that. I don't know. And I understand why. It's a different argument, and I get that, too.
Let me follow that up, if I might. When Chapter 770 was enacted, was there any severability provision as part of that enactment?
I would have to double-check. I haven't read that recently, but I will try to get that information for you if I could.
Thank you.
I apologize. I don't.
We can check that. Thank you.
Opposing counsel will say.
I think the point about is interesting about sort of striking down an entire chapter, and I guess I would, in closing, pivot back to my point about the burden of proof. There's a significant burden in place here, and I would submit quite a extra significant when you're trying to strike down something, an entire chapter of the law that was created by the legislature.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Nemox. Will it make it constitutional if we change some of these constituent parts?
I believe it would, Madam Chief Justice, and I believe the court has the power to do that. And I'll be responsive to that question since you and Justice Bradley and Justice Rogensack have asked about the remedy. We've invoked Chapter 813, the injunctive relief portion in our complaint of this, and the court does have power under subsection 8 of Chapter 813 to do that which it deems necessary and proper, and I think to address what we believe is the constitutional infirmity here. I would also point the court to a Court of Appeals decision that was not in the briefing, but which specifically talks about a statute that was struck down as unconstitutional. And the name of that case is Butzlaff, B-U-T-Z-L-A-F-F. The citation is 115 Wisconsin 2nd, 535. This is a 1983 case recognizing the rule that when a statute is unconstitutional, it is void ab initio, but private parties who reasonably relied upon the statute in the interim should not be held liable for acting in good faith. And so this goes, I think, to your question, Justice Bradley, about the ramifications. I don't know that the ramifications of declaring 770 unconstitutional, if this court uses all the power available to it, necessarily need negatively impact all the couples who have a domestic partnership.
When you say if this court uses all the powers it has, are you referring to 813? Is that what
yes,
you're
ma'am.
Talking
that's,
about?
That's what I'm referring
are
to.
Are you asking this court to delete or rewrite part of the statute, 770, to remove any perceived unconstitutional impediment?
No, ma'am, I'm not, and the petitioners are not. I'm simply recognizing that as I read the statutory scheme, I believe the court has the power, because when subsection 8 says that which the court finds necessary and proper, if that's how you envision what is necessary and proper, you could, but that is not the request of the petitioners.
Let me put a request to you. If okay. we were to strike down the consanguinity requirement, nothing else in Chapter 770, leave it in place in all the places where benefits are given to people throughout the state, but that one quality was taken out. Is it unconstitutional in your view?
It is still unconstitutional, Justice Rogensack, because, among other things, it still has the sex specificity requirement in there, which is, again, unique to marriage.
Okay, I'll take out the sex specific requirement so that you can be a man and woman and engage in a domestic partnership. So now we've dropped the gender, which you objected to when I asked you that before, and the close relation restriction. We're going to eliminate that. What do you say? It's constitutional now?
I say that Chapter 770 would allow, for example, two sisters to live together to have a domestic partnership
yep.
and to support each other, and that would not be viewed as a marriage-like relationship.
So you think it's constitutional?
I believe that it likely would be, but as I said before, I'm sure that the legislature, to the extent that there was a legislative intervention or process involved, I don't want to sit here and speak for the legislature as to how it was viewed. But
we could do it under our equitable powers.
I believe that you could.
We could take out the consanguinity. We could say, a domestic partnership can be same sex or you can be heterosexual. You know, I know a number of folks that might be interested in that.
Well, but there's also a question as to whether the legislature would want to do that as well. And so what the court could do is actually give the legislature a window to address what this court believes are the constitutional infirmities associated with Chapter 770.
So you don't want us to rewrite it, or you do want us to rewrite it?
What we're asking the court to do specifically is to declare Chapter 770 unconstitutional in its entirety. That is the specific request. And to enjoin the defendants, in this case, from further enforcing the chapter. And that is the specific request in our complaint, and that's what we have maintained. And what the petitioners are offering this court is some semblance of what is constitutional versus what is not, whereas neither the circuit court nor the court of appeals nor my esteemed opponents can offer this court any line whatsoever that can be drawn in the court of appeals or the circuit court's analysis that allows anybody to understand when we reach the line of constitutionality versus unconstitutionality. It is an inherently unworkable standard.
Yeah, but your standard of constituent parts doesn't matter if the other standard is unworkable. Once we get your standard taken care of, the end.
That is correct, Madam Chief Justice.
So we don't have to worry about them if we accept that.
If the constituent elements are correct, the benefits and incidents are not a factor. That's correct.
We're taking out gender. We're taking out close relationship. What else do we have to take out?
The exclusivity requirement is something that is unique to marriage and context.
Exclusivity means you can't have two domestic partnerships going on at the same time. But marriage has a different kind of exclusivity, too, and that relates to sexual activity. Because under 944.16, there's a requirement of fidelity. That's the adultery statute. And that doesn't apply to domestic partnerships. And therefore, there's a very different exclusivity in domestic partnerships and in marriage.
I don't know that the section of code that you've quoted, Madam Chief Justice, is one of what I would call a constituent element, which by the way, the term may be new, but the elements have been around from the very beginning, and this Court has alluded to that. But
tell me, where do you get the constituent parts? Not in my marriage ceremony. Not in the stuff I've read. You don't talk about children. You don't talk about procreation. You don't talk about mutual support. You don't talk about love. Where do you get these constituent parts? Where did you define them other than in your own construct?
Well, we first pulled them from the Wisconsin Code and the requirements associated with obtaining that legal status. And then this Court's precedent, dating back to the 1800s, where it refers to marriage as more than just a contract, but a relationship, a status obtained unto the parties and to themselves and with regard to their community. And Chapter 770 creates a competing marriage-like intimate domestic relationship that is marriage-like in its essence as to its core. What its basic nature is, what this Court referred to, and I'll use the word earlier, the character of the relationship is a word that was used in McConkie in looking at it. That is what the marriage amendment goes to, something that is marriage-like. And a Vermont-style civil union is marriage-like because it includes all of those elements. I see that my time has expired.
You know, and that's never stopped any of us before. I appreciate the observation.
You should stop me.
In any event, Mike, along the lines of what the Chief Justice was asking about, rather than go part by part and, you know, have this kind of guessing game, well, if we struck this, would it be acceptable to you? Tell me, what would, under your reading of the 2006 amendment, what would be a relationship that would be similar, but not substantially similar?
Justice Gableman, one of the things that was mentioned in the legislative debates or the debates surrounding the relationship is what's called a reciprocal beneficiary agreement. And I am aware of two states that have invoked this at any given point in time, and that's Hawaii and Colorado. And a reciprocal beneficiary arrangement, which was mentioned and was mentioned by proponents as something that would be acceptable under the marriage amendment, has an age restriction. You're age 18. It does not have a sex specificity or a consanguinity requirement that you're of competency to contract and you are not in a marriage or other domestic legal status. That's it. Those are the requirements. That's something that would encompass the examples that we mentioned in our brief of a granddaughter living with a grandfather or two sisters.
So to borrow a phrase I read in one of the briefs, the bundle of benefits and obligations wouldn't matter to your client, as long as those were the form, well, to use your phrase, constituent parts.
Yes, sir, that's correct. And I won't comment on the wisdom of giving every marital incident to a reciprocal beneficiary arrangement, but as far as the Constitution and the text is concerned, the concern was clearly with the status or the marriage-like construct, the legal construct, and not with benefits. That's both clear from the face of the text expressly and from, we believe, the intent of the sponsors and the debate surrounding it.
Counsel, Justice Crooks has a question. Justice Crooks?
Yeah, I just want to, based on our own case law and the discussion that's been going on in regard to striking various provisions of Chapter 770, whether or not you know, was there a severability clause in Chapter 770?
I was able to look for about 10 seconds at Chapter 770 before I came up here, and I did not see a section enumerated severability.
Ordinarily, it would be in the session laws, not in the statutes.
I did not see anything that indicated that it was specifically severable, but I do have Chapter 990 that's just been handed to me that has a severability provision under 990.001, subsection 11.
That's the general construction statute.
Right, that the provisions of the statutes are severable. So if that is a general statutory rule that is provided under Chapter 990 to this Court.
Read the first part. It says, unless otherwise something or other.
Are you talking about the very beginning, the introduction?
Yep.
In construing Wisconsin laws, the following rules shall be observed unless construction in accordance with the rule would produce a result inconsistent with the manifest intent of the legislature. Yeah.
That's so, why they sometimes include a special separability clause.
Correct. And I did not see one, again, on my review. Madam Chief Justice, would you like me to answer the question, the U.S. Supreme Court question?
No, I think the red light's been on too long, okay. Counsel. I'm sorry, Justice Prosser.
I'm getting an impression from your argument, and I'd like to have you either correct my impression or respond to my impression. In putting all of, laser-like, putting the focus on constituent elements and not about the benefits and privileges, I get a sense that you're rolling the dice here. And that if you prevail, but if you don't prevail on the question of whether this is a substantially similar or whatever the language is, the legislature can add benefits, bing, 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 and you don't have an argument anymore.
I believe, Justice Prosser, that the way we are construing the amendment is the only way that the amendment can be reasonably construed. And the reason I say that is because with no limiting principle being offered to this court as to the analysis employed by the Circuit Court and the Court of Appeals, that means that the amendment's second sentence could be functionally rendered illusory, because all the legislature has to do is stop one benefit short of according all the benefits of marriage, and then we don't have what our opponents have interpreted as a Vermont-style civil union, different interpretation from ours. And I think that would render it illusory. The only way, I think, to be true to the text of the amendment and its plain meaning is to focus on the legal status that is not functionally dependent upon what benefits exist. And I reiterate that if the legislature changed the benefits of marriage tomorrow, it would not, in the mind, I respectfully submit, of any Wisconsin citizen, change what marriage means or how marriage is viewed, and the nature of the legal status that the citizens who have that have.
So I take it from that your answer to Justice Prosser is yes?
To the extent that could be viewed as rolling the dice or gambling, I suppose so. I didn't look at it that way.
I didn't mean the first question. I meant the last one. Sorry. And that was that if we adopted your view of constituent parts, that the legislature could continue adding benefits and you would have nothing to say about it.
If the legislature, if you adopted
your view of constituent parts,
okay,
and crafted a remedy consistent with what you suggest, then the legislature could add whatever benefits and you would have no cause for complaint.
That is correct.
I thought you wanted us to get rid of 770.
He does.
I do.
So if we got rid of it, then the legislature would have to start fresh.
There would be nothing for the legislature to add to.
Exactly.
But I presume that the legislature would respond at some level. And in that regard, if they responded with a legal status that is not substantially similar to marriage.
And your response was given under the parameters of both Justice Prosser's question and my follow-up question.
Correct. With my being distracted for gambling. Thank you very much for the time.
Thank you, Mr. Nimmer. Thank you, Mr. Clark, for your argument today. And case is of great interest to many people in the state, in the legislature, and executive, and the court. That ends our argument in 11AP 572, Appling versus Walker. The court is adjourned of oral argument for the month of October. The court will meet in the conference room at 3:20.